This podcast is sponsored by Rask Invest, Owen's complete guide to money and investing. Visit the Rask Finance website to learn more and join today.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast, a series exploring the investment philosophies and journeys of some of Australia's leading investors and financial thinkers. I'm Owen Raskovich, founder of the Rask Group. For show notes and other episodes in this series, as well as free educational resources, please visit www.raskfinance.com. Before we go on, it's important to remember the Australian Investors Podcast is provided for educational purposes only and should not be relied upon to make an investment, financial, or taxation decision. The information included in this podcast does not take into account your needs, goals, or objectives, and guests appearing on the show may have a financial interest in some of the products mentioned. Please read all the important disclosure documents and refer to the Rask Group's Financial Services Guide on the Rask Finance website. My guest for this episode is Pete Wargent. Pete is one of Australia's leading property economists and investors, a best-selling author and blogger. Having reached financial independence at 33, Pete is now a regular on TV and splits his time between the UK and Noosa. From the outside, Pete's journey seems to include success after success. But as you'll discover in this conversation, Pete's journey included many ups and downs, hard work and sacrifice. I know you'll enjoy this conversation with Pete Wargent. Pete, thanks for joining me on the show.
Pleasure.
Lots to talk about. Not only are you a best-selling author, you run a daily blog, you wear multiple hats, and you're financially independent by 33. So there's probably people hearing that sitting back thinking, geez, 33, what am I doing? Myself included, I'm thinking the same thing. So there's lots to talk about, and I just want to say thanks for appearing, mate. It's great to have you.
Yeah, pleasure. It's great to be down in Melbourne.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay, you're native to Brisbane now?
Yeah, actually, I live in Noosa, actually, so couple of hours north.
Yeah, great. So you've written a number of books, and I found out today just before we were talking off air, and you've written another one.
It's kind of the next in the series, and the subject is financial literacy for the young.
Great.
So I think it's a growth area of interest, and what I've tried to do in that book is I've taken some of the traditional ideas of financial habits and financial literacy for young people, and I've tried to bring it forward into the 21st century, because a lot of things have changed in terms of younger people not seeing cash as much as we used to, more use of cards and afterpay and all the other things. So so some traditional ideas, but also some other new ideas in terms of what type of careers are becoming obsolete and what's becoming more in demand. So, it covers quite a spectrum.
It's great. And obviously starting the debate or starting the thought process earlier on is really important, because that's where we develop a lot of these habits. And even for the parents themselves that perhaps don't have the skills, you go into a library and there might be 50 books on parenting. Obviously there's no one right answer, right?
Yeah, and that's actually self-evident, because you find that a lot of people from a similar background. I mean, I'm from a large family of seven, and people take different paths through life despite having the same upbringing. So clearly how you respond to your environment is as important as what happens to you. But there's, it's not as popular in Australia, but over in the UK, there used to be this hugely popular series called the Up series, 7 Up. And the idea was that they could take a broad cross-section of Brits at the age of seven, and the idea was they could predict how people's lives would play out.
So,
it's a Jesuit saying from more than 400 years ago, give me the boy of seven and I will show you the man. And it's a bit of an arrogant concept for a series, but the basic premise was that. And but by and large, you did find that people from the more privileged or wealthy backgrounds, I mean, they went into professional practice and became law partners and so on. And people from more humble backgrounds, they followed by and large the type of path that the producers expected. So there is something in it, because those, the habits, it's almost like hypnosis. When you're born, you've got no context whatsoever for how to survive on this planet. So we pick up all these messages from our environment, and that's how we learn the programming. And they reckon, now, this is developmental biology, but they reckon about 95% of the programming and how you behave is delivered in the first 7 years. So that's why it's so important. Now, you can change the programming. That's the good news. But unless you consciously make an effort to do so, a lot of your path in life is almost predetermined by the age of seven.
Mm. What prompted you to write this book after you've written a few others?
Becoming a parent, that was the driver. So we've got two young kids, and I thought I've read all this stuff on personal finance over the years, and I thought, but you know, I've always often read, it's important instilling good habits at a young age, but I said, well, that's fine, but what does that actually mean?
So what habits?
Yeah, that was the trigger for it. So I did read as widely as I could on the psychology of it, but also the practical habits, and also how things changing, because the world of finance is changing. So that was the driver for it. It took me a period of time to obviously do the research and come up with a book, but the finished product is now out there.
Yeah, great. And I don't think we mentioned the name.
It's Wealthways for the Young. So, and it's written for parents, and there's also a section for teenagers to read as well. So it's I presented down at the Gold Coast a couple of weeks ago at the Somerset Story Fest, huge event for schools in Queensland. And speaking to the year 12s was pretty easy because those guys study business and economics. Speaking to some of the grade eights in a 40 degree marquee was hard work, but it was all good fun and well received.
Yeah. Well, that's what you got to do, right? When you launch a book, you've got to get it in front of people, see how they receive it. And the schools, I imagine, are just craving this sort of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough for schools. From their perspective, it's tough because there's a certain expectation. The curriculum needs to cover these things. Financial literacy, you know, it's just one more thing that they've got to try and squeeze in. But the college down there, Somerset, I mean, they're a forward thinking type of education environment. They have a course for entrepreneurs and, you know, we did a breakfast on financial literacy. So, not all schools have that capability, but they're really among the best.
The reason I think this is a really good place to start a conversation, because you, reading your books, you as a child, it seems, you know, if we fast forward to today, you're highly respected, you know, as an economist or a property guy, also just an all-round holistic, I suppose, wealth coach, right? But you yourself, it didn't start, you know, you didn't come from a very, I should say, financially literate family, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yeah, maybe I come across a bit derogatory in the way I describe it sometimes, but it was a different time. So, the current thing in the last couple of years has been limiting the amount that people can borrow. In fact, APRA's had to put out a practice guide. Because the appetite for debt these days, when you've got the lowest interest rates in the generation, is very different from the period when I grew up and our parents' generation, 17% interest rates. You know, the goal was to get out of debt as quickly as possible. But of course, my parents being public sector people, it was all about the pension and pay off your home. So there was no stock ownership in Britain. A few people got onto the British Telecom quote, and there was a couple of other floats, I should say, and there was a couple of other sort of flotations where people became part of the stakeholder economy was the buzzword at the time. But actually, most people didn't own stocks; it just wasn't the done thing. And investment property is the same. There was a few professional landlords, but in the part of the world where I grew up, that was almost a swear word, I guess. And for most people, you bought a home, you paid it off at very high interest rates, and the pension was everything.
And that the pension came from the company that you worked for, right?
Yeah, or in the yes, that's right. So the defined benefit pension scheme, and for people in the public sector, it was pension for life, essentially. So you retired on a final salary pension scheme, and if you lived to be 100, the pension just kept on going. But of course, in the time between growing up and entering the workforce, we're shifting very much across to defined contribution in Britain and accumulation funds, obviously, in Australia.
Mm. And then for those that don't know, that's where you contribute regular amounts. And then when you hit 65 or whatever you have is whatever you have.
Yeah, that's right. So it shifted the responsibility a lot more onto individuals, whether they realize it or not. Because if you think about some of the British companies like I suppose someone like Rolls-Royce would be a good example. I was a chartered accountant, and when you know, when we had to bring under international accounting standards, we had to bring the pension liabilities onto the balance sheet. Mm-hmm. You know, some of those companies found out that their pension liabilities, you know, a couple of billion pounds, it dwarfed the rest of the balance sheet. So,
The liabilities for paying pensions was greater than the value of the company in some cases.
Oh, yeah. In some cases, some of the big supermarkets and so on, it wiped out, you know, half the balance sheet. So, and I think that was at that time, there was a growing awareness of the, some of the pension deficits. Mm-hmm. And, there was a big shift. And these days, the pensions in Britain very much about the contribution and not a defined benefit when you retire.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit more about your upbringing. Obviously, still have an accent. Where did you grow up? And one of the things I like to ask is who, if anyone, influenced you towards this path of investing and money and property in your instance?
Yeah, so you wouldn't know it today from my relatively well-spoken accent, but I grew up in South Yorkshire, a place called Sheffield. Mm-hmm. So that was, it was a pretty, I suppose, depressed sort of city in those days because the steel industry famously contracted and the South Yorkshire coal mines were all being shut down. So the population of Sheffield was shrinking. My dad worked in corrective services. So he ran a hostel for young offenders. So I guess you might call it like a halfway house. So that's where I grew up. So pretty, I suppose, lively sort of place. And my dad's work by its very nature took us to sort of those kind of areas. And, so that's where I grew up. And, you see a different side of life in those kind of locations. But, very much, despite that, from a very middle class sort of background, my parents were idealist, socialists, I suppose is the phrase of the day. So, my mum was a sort of an anti-nuclear campaigner, and she worked as a teacher in schools. These days you'd have a different name for it. They used to call them special schools, but I suppose you'd call them schools for people with troubled domestic situations or upbringings. Mm. So they were very much about fairness, equality, and helping others. So left-wing politics these days, it doesn't always get a great rap, but it came from a good place. So very much about helping people less fortunate.
You grew up with brothers, only brothers, right?
Yeah, so there's a lot of us. So Catholic family. So it was as many children as God sends. So yeah, all boys though. So it's a pretty sort of lively place to grow up. And but it was all good fun.
Have any of them settled out here in Australia or?
No, one of my younger brothers lived in Perth. He actually taught at the school at Christchurch there for a while. But he lives in South Korea. The others have, it's a bit of a diaspora, but they're mainly settled around London.
Mm. I'm interested because you mentioned before that back in those days, someone may have got some stock from an IPO or a float of a private company. In one of your books, you say that the one thing you take away from your folks and their attitude towards investing was the value in education and investing in your own learning. So I'm interested in that period where you go from, you know, going around these potential housing projects or whatever with your parents to then going on to study. So what happened where did you go to study and what happened next?
Yeah, so I studied at the university in Sheffield. It wasn't an overnight thing for me. I suppose one thing, our parents were very keen on us going to university. And my parents met at university in Sheffield. They were keen that we went on to higher education. But in terms of career guidance, we didn't really get much in that. You know, we weren't pushed in any particular direction. I was interested in finance, numbers, that kind of thing. So I guess I gravitated towards the idea of being a chartered accountant, the two reasons. One, I just thought it's a good career. It's just good grounding because you can go on to be CFO or Group FC, that kind of role. But also, there was another driver that came later, and that's that I'd spent some time as a backpacker in Australia. And back in those days, chartered accountant was 60 points on the permanent residency application. Plus, I think you got an extra 30 points if you'd done 3 years with a firm. So for me, that was quite a big driver to get the qualification because then I could get dual citizenship and spend time in Australia. And that's actually what played out.
Because you came here to play cricket, is that right?
Yeah, that's so my first experience of, Aussies was playing cricket in England. So I used to play at the same club as Alistair Cook, who's a bit younger than me, but he's a really good guy, very, very talented. So we used to have quite a few overseas players who'd come, usually one or two a year, depending on if they could find a European heritage somewhere that could get them across the line. But quite a number of those had played at the Waverley Club, which is in Bondi in Sydney. And that sowed the seed of the idea, let's go and play a season in Australia. And I found when I came out, I guess like a lot of young people, you know, I was out of my comfort zone. I didn't have as many friends and family around. Loved the cricket. It was really good. I improved my game no end. But it was, I guess towards the end of the season, we had a bit of a sort of, a boys, you know, surfing holiday up the coast and drove up to Noosa and Surfers and all those places. And I guess it was only at that stage I thought, oh, hang on a second, you know, I don't want to be going back to the English winter. So, and that's what sowed the seed, really. I did in the end follow through with that.
Yeah, so you went and you studied and then you move into I think it was a mid-tier firm and you're working in auditing, is that right?
Yeah, it's a pretty, very sort of traditional bread and butter career, I guess. I started in the West End of London, a firm that was just on the edge of Mayfair. So there was mid-tier accounting. That's where I did my... what they used to call them articles, I guess you call them exams these days, and experience. So 3 years in auditing and assurance. I think actually that's where I started to see, because mid-tier firms, you have a lot of high net worth individuals, successful business owners, not so much in the way of the listed companies. Mm-hmm. And that's where I started to say, hang on. You know, these guys have assets and they have investments working for them and have multiple business interests. And I suppose it was a bit of an eye-opener, having come from I guess what you would call a socialist family background, mm-hmm. where you know that kind of thing was just that's another world, you know. And it seems it's different today. That there's no such thing in those days as New Labour and centrist politics. It was very much, it was Tories for business and Labour for trade unions. So my parents were trade unionists, and that was the way it was back in those days. There was no middle ground. Going to work in London in the West End and seeing working for a lot of high net worths, it's like it just opened my eyes to the other side, I suppose. Yeah.
So you wrote a bit in your book. You say things like your focus at this stage began, you didn't fully make the conversion, but you've began to shift your focus away from, say, income, but more so to developing those assets for lifelong wealth.
Yeah, it took some time. So I think, when you start out in that type of professional practice career, you start out on a good graduate salary, and then you get up 3 years, you qualify, then you can go on and become a supervisor or manager, and you maybe, at that stage, you might be earning... Well, you become a high rate taxpayer, essentially.
Yeah.
And that's when you at that stage, you suddenly starts to click that actually the more you earn, the more tax you pay. You buy a sports car, you buy your first home, but it very, very easily gets spent. And you also see people further on down that track and they're still doing the same thing, maybe 30 or 40 years later, which is great for some people, but not for everyone. And so, that's where the seed started to be planted. And I suppose it was when I went to Deloitte, which is one of the big four, obviously. I met my then girlfriend, now wife, and she was absolutely miles ahead of me financially. And she was a couple of years older and a senior manager and essentially my boss to all intents and purposes. And I think that's when I saw, I could see how, buying your first house in Cambridge for her, paying down a massive chunk of the mortgage, investing in the stock market, and seeing her net worth up here and me still, nearer the beginning. That was like a big eye opener for me.
There's a story that you tell in your book, Get a Financial Grip, about you start by saying the incredibly tough or long work hours you were doing, all nighters, 36-hour days, etc. And then you walk into a meeting.
The good old days, yeah.
Do you remember that? Do you know the meeting that I'm talking about?
Yeah, I remember the anecdote in the book. And essentially, Yeah, I mean, I guess people have picked me up on this. So that never happened, but it definitely did. And I can get people to vouch for me. But yeah, the partners were, they were essentially, ranked, and it goes on all the way through in professional practice. It never goes away. But the number of chargeable hours per qualified accountant in the office, and and they were saying, we're right up at the top of this list. And I was kind of sitting there thinking, as a young manager, I think, but why is that a good thing? I've clocked up a few hundred hours for the month, and there's no change to your remuneration. Mm. It's benefiting somebody else. And my now wife Heather, she pitched in and said, well, hang on a sec, if we're not getting paid overtime, how you positioning this is a good thing. That was the way it was in Big Four. It was even in the job interview, they said, look, we want our pound of flesh. But the good thing about a Big Four accounting career is that there's a very structured career path. So you're only ever maybe 18 months away from the next pay rise, the next promotion, the next bonus. Mm. That path through from analyst to senior analyst to manager, senior manager, director, partner, it's all laid out. Mm. I guess we went through that system. It's a pretty hard thing to step off the gravy train, I guess.
Yeah. For the people who aren't familiar with the environment or the chargeable hours, can you just explain how that, I suppose, your performance is, or your KPIs in a big accounting firm like that?
Yeah, so that, I mean, they essentially used to email out a spreadsheet once a month, and it was basically the name or shame. So I guess if you worked for, if a company selling fax machines, it would be the person that made the most sales. But for us as young managers, it's how many hours of time that you can charge to a client have you actually done in a given week or a given month? The bigger accounting firms, most managers will have a listed company client or two. So they, obviously with the listed companies, you've got quarterly reporting, half years, you've got 4 years. So they're beasts that they feed on themselves. Mm. It became almost a competition. Who can record the most hours that they can charge to clients over a month? And it's, you don't want to be on the spreadsheet that gets emailed out being the person that didn't put the hours in. And there was a general pressure. You didn't want to be seen to be leaving the office at 6 o'clock if other people were staying till 10 or 11. So, working weekends was normal. It's a competitive environment, but it was a lot of good fun as well, I should say.
Okay. Cause I mean, most people think, 9 to 5 doesn't end there if you run your own business or you're trying to become a partner in one of these accounting firms, right?
No. But the thing where you find when you run your own show, as you know, that the hours are not always sociable, and so you're doing it at your own volition. So it's different, but it's, I guess when you're creating your own thing, it's, you're much more passionate.
Oh, for sure. So after your time at Deloitte, did you get married in Australia? Is that what happened?
Yeah, at, Kiama Beach. So, we thought quite, carefully about invites because I'm from a large family. Plus, you've got your brothers, they're other halves. My parents are, and they're new partners. And before we knew it, our list was up to a lot. Yeah. And we just thought logistically, we're in Australia, a lot of our friends and family are in Europe. And in the end, we just, it was very quick and a simple wedding on the beach. Nobody invited, just a photographer and a registrar, and that was it. But it was great.
Oh, lovely. Is that around the? Were you already settled in Australia, or?
We actually came. I've spent quite a bit of time in Australia from the 1990s, but I actually came out. I became a permanent resident in 2004. It was sometime after that we settled down here, got married, bought our place in the eastern suburbs of Sydney. But the thing is, our plan was always to try and split our time between England and Australia, hence why I've never lost the English accent. Because we still, even now, we spend maybe 5 months of the year in the UK, right, and the rest here. So resets my accent each year, which is good.
So is it the winter that you take off here in Australia, and you want the summer back there, or how does that work?
Well, that was the grand idea. It's okay. never really worked that way. So I guess the thing is with in Australia, not much happens really through December and January. So it's a natural period to spend overseas. The trouble is in you know, December's great in Britain, lead up to Christmas, you know, stuff going on, friends and family. Mm. Yeah, I'd say January is a bit trying at times because it's cold, it's dark, yeah. And you know, everyone's going back to work and they're miserable. So, yeah, look, it doesn't, yeah, the grass isn't always greener. It doesn't always work out as planned, but, yeah, I'm not going to complain.
Mm. So you come to Australia and, if I'm not mistaken, you were still working with Deloitte?
Yeah, it wasn't the plan. So I had, I got my Australian residency and I could, you know, within reason, I could do anything, but I just thought, well, I suppose, you know, I'd been through at that point of changing, you know, change of relationship, you know, change of country, moving to a new house, lots of disruption.
Right.
And I figured that maybe some continuity on the career front wouldn't hurt. It wasn't necessarily the plan to stay there too long, but yeah, I did, I think maybe a year or two at Deloitte in Sydney, a couple of years, I think at most, before I then went off into industry. But yeah, initially I was working there.
You talk about some, it's probably poor framing to say it was a dark time, but there were times where you've had this sort of realization, this moment where you've gone, okay, I'm, you know, working ridiculous hours, I'm eating junk food, I'm way too much caffeine and beers. Like, was there a moment for you where it kind of like reset everything in your lifestyle, but also your attitude towards your finances?
Yeah, I think the financial thing, you know, I think that was already in train for me, but yeah, I guess the nature of that type of work hard, play hard lifestyle, if you like, which is quite normal in London and Sydney, and it's people feel like they've worked hard, so the, you know, Friday night and Saturday in the pub, you know, it's pretty common for people in their mid-20s. But yeah, I found that, and I think actually it was a combination probably of all of those things, you know, change of job, change of country, poor, you know, dietary habits, you know, in the office drinking coffee all day and then, you know, boozing in the evening, a combination of all those things and that disruption, it was giving rise to quite a bit of anxiety, which is one of those things that some people never get it, some people do, but yeah, I used to get dreadful anxiety attacks, but I can see now with hindsight, I could see the drivers of it, but at the time I didn't really understand what was going on because I felt, you know, the young, fairly confident person, these things shouldn't be happening to me. But
yeah, pretty healthy, you're still running marathons and all the rest of it, right?
Yeah, and also, but you generally find that, yeah, that type of anxiety has a root cause. And for me, I just wasn't living a life that was congruent, I guess. You know, these days I run my own business, I do what I feel like doing. But I was, you know, working in professional practice, Big Four, I was a square peg in a round hole, for want of a better phrase. And, yeah, there was, it was a disruptive time anyway, you know, moving away from family and all the rest of it. So, yeah, it's a difficult thing to explain if you've never suffered from anxiety and panic attacks and things like that, because they're not rational by their very nature. And, yeah, that was a difficult thing to go through. But these days people will talk about it much more openly. Back then, I don't think it was such the done thing. So, yeah, it was interesting times, but, yeah, I guess there was certainly something that once I started running my own business, became much more motivated in terms of productivity, and it a lot of stuff flowed on from there. So these days I'm, you know, vegan. I start the day with a run at the beach and healthy food, and you know, early bed, all the rest of it. No booze. It's a very different lifestyle these days. And yeah, I look back at the, you know, me that used to, you know, smoke and drink. And it's like a different person, but I guess it just goes to show you can turn anything around.
Yeah, and speaking of turning around, we should focus our gaze now and turn to how you go from where you were at that point in your life to then at 33 being financially independent. We'll get into some of the strategies in a minute, but do you think that there were any psychological biases or social pressures or anything like that that was holding you back from what you eventually did?
Oh, 100%, yeah. And we already touched on some of them. So I think, you know, I came from an upbringing and an environment where the expectation was go to university, get a professional career, and just do, you know, the typical strategy. You know, you buy a house, get the, you know, a couple of nice cars, you know, you pay down the mortgages. Mm-hmm. That was essentially the that's what everyone did in my social group. But I think, yeah, there's a peer pressure thing too, because there's that old phrase that you're the person, or you're the sum of the six people you spend the most time with. And I do believe that's true. Mm. Because even if it's an unconscious thing, you pick up, messages from other people, you mirror their behaviors. And if you're hanging out with people who are, acting in a certain way, you're very likely to follow. So it takes a bit of conscious reprogramming to take a different path, but that's what we decided to do. And we literally sat down and mapped out, right, don't want to be doing this for the next 40 years. This is how we're going to get out of it. And, one of the things we learned is that it never goes completely according to plan. Mm. But if you've got a big target and a big plan and push towards it, well, you can adjust course on the way. Mm. So that's what we did. We literally sat down, I guess at the age of, I don't know, 28. It's like, look, we've made some good progress. We've got two, my wife is a director at Deloitte, and then she went into industry and did some pretty senior roles. I was on a good bit of coin as well. It's like, right, how do we leverage this into a better result? And there was a bit of luck along the way, as you hope for, but I guess the thing is actually making that decision. That was the important thing.
Do you think you would have come to the same conclusion or made that same plan without her?
No, not at all. No, it's I think so. My wife's from a very different background, so family of farmers, and the thing in farming. But they certainly had this view that you acquire land, you don't sell it. And, I guess that's a very sort of Aussie attitude to real estate. But that was certainly her upbringing. Her parents had come from literally nothing, built up a farm. Mm-hmm. They bought fields and land, and they'd never sold anything. And she's followed that same approach. Now, I see, being a bloke, I like the idea of trading more and buying and selling, but she's been adamant ever since day one, since we were buying up properties around Sydney and London, other places. She's been adamant we never sell, just buy good assets and don't sell them. And I regularly fantasize about selling down assets and doing different things, but she's said, no, that's not what I was taught. You buy land, you don't sell it. So and that actually rubbed off on me. Just the idea of the power of compounding.
Mm. It seems like you're quite the duo, and I suppose people hearing this who may not have a partner, that they might be a bit off-put, but I guess, and I've said this a lot because I've talked to a few guests who said, probably the best investment I've ever made is in my partner, and being in a relationship has been fantastic for me.
I'm going to say that in case Heather's listening, so yes.
Yeah,
it is true in my case.
But it's true, right? That gives you the option of the optionality in your life, so to speak. And for me, I wouldn't be able to start my business without a partner that I could trust, and we were in it together.
Yeah, for sure. And in fact, one of the biggest hurdles for somebody who wants to, if you've got a business idea or a startup, or you want to go and day trade or whatever it is, if you've got somebody else that supports you, and because as you know, statistically, most businesses don't make it through the first year or two.
Mm.
If you've got somebody who can say, all right, well, let's save up a buffer. Let's, maybe I'll do some contracting work for the first 6 months or a year or whatever it is. Just until you've got things up and running. I mean, it can make it all the difference. It's a harder gig on your own, for sure.
For sure. I mean, you're taking a risk, right? Whatever you do. If you're an entrepreneur, you're taking a risk, and having someone on your side just lowers the risk. It's just almost, you don't appreciate it until you have it.
But. Yeah. And in fact, in our specific case, we'd saved up a buffer and had this plan. I was going to set up my own business.
Mm-hmm.
We'd spent some time traveling. But Heather said, look, we didn't have kids at this stage, and she did a bit of, contracting work at a couple of, let's say, on the Barangaroo project and stuff that. And just having that peace of mind to actually be able to not be panicking about cash flows and, investing in this, that, and the other to get started up. I mean, it makes all the difference for an entrepreneur or a startup. It's a huge benefit.
Mm. Shifting gears now, if you weren't accountants, would it have been different, do you think? Or do you think you naturally had the skill set, the technical skills?
If you look at a lot of accountants don't have great portfolios, so I don't know that it necessarily follows. I mean, I suppose the useful skill sets you learn, because I was a group FC for a couple of listed companies. I was head of tax compliance. So, you know, I used to write annual reports. So it does, for sure, it gives you an edge, because I think a lot of people wouldn't have the same insights into what accounting standards actually mean. You know, what do all the notes actually mean in an annual report? So some of that stuff is useful. I think understanding this very simple concepts like your personal balance sheet.
Can you explain P&L. That a bit?
Well, so in terms of, so like every company has its assets and its liabilities, but it's exactly the same for a person. So you've got your assets, which typically for most people is your home, your superannuation. Mm-hmm. If you do investment properties or share portfolios, whatever it is, those are your typically your assets. So people might include their golf clubs or car or whatever, but things that are actually going to make you money. And then you've got your liabilities, which for most people is their home loan. But I guess as an accountant, you learn quite quickly, because you prepare accounts for people and for businesses, that having liabilities against things like cars and boats and stuff that isn't going to actually help you move ahead. If you could have learned to eliminate that debt and only have debt that's actually working for you. I guess as an accountant, that stuff is the bread and butter. You know, you understand double entry bookkeeping and all of that. So I think it does help, but it's how you use that information that matters.
I'm sure we both know accountants that are like sieves with money. You just give them some and it disappears.
And there's a certain lifestyle expectation, I guess, that goes with being a partner in a law firm or an accounting firm. And I suppose, you know, that's the modern trap, isn't it? That we were talking before we came on about the lifestyle you want is always on the horizon. Yeah. And it's the same in any line of work.
It's that lifestyle inflation, right?
Mm.
Early on your path to this financial independence, you talk a bit about in the books the strategies that you use. And one of those is using index funds and trading and property for wealth. We'll start with the everything that's not property, because we'll get to that in a minute. How did you go about learning about those subjects? And also, what were some of the resources you used? Were there good books that you are fond of?
Yeah. So when I did my school's prezo the other day, this was a literature festival, and I reeled off a Charlie Munger quote about, he's never met any successful people who are not readers. So I was trying to impart on the kids, leaders are readers, like the old adage says. But I've always been a mad reader. So I read everything, every book I could find on stock markets. So, all the way from, Ben Graham to some really dodgy books on day trading. And so I've read everything, and I figured that, even from the worst books, you learn something. Even if it's what doesn't work, you'll always come away with something. So, I've read some really good books on the Aussie stock market. So Peter Thornhill, Colin Nicholson, I loved all that stuff. So I was just like a sponge. In terms of my strategies, I guess I figured as a CA who wrote annual reports, I figured, well, surely to me, being a value investor, it makes perfect sense, right? But I guess it took me some time to realize that you can analyze an annual report till the ink falls off the page, but you can still make cock-ups. So these days, I guess I'm in a different position, because I'm further on in my journey, and I tend to take a more, I'll still try and buy things when they're cheap, but it's more likely to be an ETF or an index these days. But it's horses for courses. These days I don't necessarily need big returns, whereas back then I was much more impatient. As you said, I did share trading. Back in the days when margin loans were very popular, options, CFDs, they gave everything a run. I guess it's working out what works for you, because investing is not all about the numbers. It's also about finding something that fits your personality type. And I guess I worked out in time. I think I was at a seminar. There's a guy called Roger Hamilton, and he talks about the different personality types. And it just clicked. I watched his stuff and I'm like, that's it. I'm an accumulator. I just like the snowball. I guess that was it. So initially I did a lot of share trading, buying and selling, but I've actually found my best results have just been from accumulating and a buy and hold approach. I know it's not trendy these days, but that's nevertheless true.
So it was as simple as monthly paycheck comes in, X percent goes to index funds, X percent goes here, et cetera?
Yeah. So when I, you mentioned when I first met my wife, and You see, back in those days, I'd get the bonus or the paycheck, and it was like, right, off, you know, off to the pub, off on a holiday, buy a new car. And she had, I think it must have been passed down to her, but ever since she was sort of a teenager or maybe 20 or something, she'd been, just dollar cost averaging. I guess it wasn't called that in Britain, but just, into the FTSE index. And there was also, she had an ethical FTSE tracker, and she's been running that now for, I guess, 23, 24 years. Mm. And we're still doing it even now. So, I mean, she introduced me to that idea when I was younger. And that's, you know, the FTSE's been through its ups and downs. And I guess with the benefits of hindsight, you might have said, well, why pick the FTSE 100? You know, why not pick another product? But I guess you do learn over time. The most important thing is actually doing something.
Mm.
And, you know, if some of those decisions could have been a bit smarter, well, you just learn for the next time.
Yeah, for sure. And you haven't, but from what I know, it wasn't all just, you know, all or nothing in the FTSE. There's other assets, and it's the house, houses in London, houses in Australia. It's not just.
Yeah, and that's, you know, still, even now, we're still in the accumulation phase. So, you know, we'll buy this year. So last year we bought we bought some farmland in the UK. We bought a place in New Farm as a renovation project in Brisbane. This year we'll buy a property in the UK. So we're just, these days it's with a lot less leverage though. Mm. So our property purchases for cash in Britain. So yes, different for a different stage, but we're still accumulating on all fronts. And if I get some excess cash in Australia, it just goes into a listed investment company and into the bottom drawer. So it's interesting. I find with so much information out there these days, the idea of a buy and hold approach doesn't seem to be very trendy, but I guess it's, you know, we're not in a situation now where we need to take big risks, so it works for us.
One of the things that you talk about in the book is almost like this cleanse or this financial reset that you did early in the piece. I think you committed to doing a marathon, and you thought socializing on the Fridays out, we're going to save. What are some of the things that you use to just, if there's people out there thinking, you know, I want to be like Pete, I want to start to save, I want to invest, what are the sacrifices you had to make to set yourself on that path?
Yeah, well, I suppose we set a goal sometime, I guess, maybe when I was 28 or something like that. We set this goal, and I'm not saying this is right for everyone, this is our journey and our experience, said we're going to buy 10 properties in 10 years. I guess it was Heather's idea. We're not going to do, buy all the junk, buy rubbish out in the sticks. It's capital city property, and we're going to save our backsides off, save the deposits, and then we've got some equity, go again.
Yep.
Now, it took us a bit longer than 10 years to do in the end, because I guess because we focused on Sydney and London, and, you know, those deposits don't come cheap. Mm. But yeah, I mean, when I spoke at the school's event the other day, I said, well, you know, I wasn't talking about real estate, but I'm just saying, if you want to get ahead in life, you have to be able to spend less than you earn. It's a very simple thing to say, but it is actually incredible how few people can actually truly manage that. So some people just have it and some don't. And yeah, I guess we figured if we're going to actually do this and get out of that 9-to-5, then we have to do something different. So it was, I guess we relocated to Australia, so that was a natural reset. So
yep.
A lot of the old standing orders and direct debits, you know, they were stopped, and it's like, okay, let's start this and do it properly from scratch. But yeah, the biggest hurdle for me was that I used to, well, as already alluded to me, it was weekends were for the pub, you know, and it's the hardest time of the week for me. If you've done a 50 or a 60-hour week, to not then knock off at 5 o'clock on a Friday in Sydney, Australia, you know, you've got the opera bar literally 50 meters away. Yeah, it's a very, to me, that was almost, it seemed an impossibility, but we made a commitment, right? We're going to do the marathon in 6 months' time. And I just used to go to the gym for 2 hours between like 5 and 7 o'clock. And then I found once you got through the first couple of hours, it wasn't so bad. But I think I did an interview recently where I was pretty resentful of that for quite a long time. Everyone else was out enjoying themselves. Mm. But, I've learned in time that, new habits form relatively quickly. And, that 6 month period, we'd set a goal of buying a property, at One Darling Harbour. So pretty prestige address. And, right. I mean, with two higher income earners, we got there, saved the deposit, bought that place. And, I suppose, you know, 6 months of your life of hard saving, but it pays itself back many times over. And it's a nice feeling today when people are talking about, oh, you know, Sydney property downturn. It's like, well, not so much at Darling Harbour, you know, it's not really, you know, hasn't really touched the side. So
yeah,
we just followed it on from there. So that was how we broke the spending trend. But you do find that actually habits, you know, these days I'm a vegetarian. Once that would have seemed like anathema to me, but these days it's been so long, it's just second nature, and that's the way habits go.
You've said before that property might be the best investment for the average investor to make, you know, to achieve that long-term financial success. And I think you've said property for wealth in the past. Why would you say that's the case for property versus, say, shares or something else?
Yeah, yeah. Well, don't get me wrong. I mean, the property shares debate, for whatever reason, I've never understood this, it gets so very tribal, especially on social media, it seems. And to some extent, people seem to be influenced by whether they are a homeowner or not, as though that has some kind of a bearing on what's going to happen. I mean, I suppose that my thought process when I wrote that, bearing in mind this is at a period when the cash rate was at 7.25% and we're coming into a resources downturn, and there was a truly massive undersupply of housing in Sydney. My thought process was, well, I mean, just look at it statistically. There are more property millionaires than there are in the stock market. Why? Because it's not a numbers thing, because, you know, logically businesses will return more on equity than a fibro shack or a house. It's an obvious point to make, but people, for whatever reason, psychologically, they trust in long-term trends in land values because there's no daily quoted price, and they will buy a house, they'll pay down the mortgage, they won't worry too much about what the market's doing, and in 20 years, they've built a massive pool of equity. Now, I know that part of that is nonsensical, because if there was a daily quoted price on the front of their house, they might look at things a bit differently, but it's just nevertheless true. I mean, if you look at the equity that's been built up in Aussie housing, I think it peaked at $5.5 trillion. You know, it's a huge amount of wealth that people can create in real estate. But it's because they've got this ability, like people can with their super, just to turn it off and just focus on paying down the mortgage. But I don't doubt that dollar for dollar, the stock market over the next 20 years will outperform the property market. There's no question. But whether or not people can actually leverage into it in the same way, that's a different question.
When if someone you don't know walks up to you on the street and they say to you,
I usually walk the other way.
Yeah, you see them coming across. So they walk up to you and they say, you know, property or shares, or which property should I buy, or whatever. What factors would you say, and we talked about personality traits, what factors would you say lend themselves well to being successful in property?
Yeah, well, I see. The question that I get more commonly is, quite often. So when I'm in London, I'll get an email, oh, I found this place in Chelsea, you know, it's a nice apartment. Do you think it's a good investment? It's you know, it's completely the wrong question, of course. So the question is, well, why, you know, do you want to own a property? Or quite often in London, because there's no restriction on foreign buyers, it's all about, I want a place where I can walk to the theatre. And do you think it's a good investment? It's, well, you've got to really start with why. You know, why are you actually doing this? Are you buying somewhere to live? Are you buying for the return on the money you invest? Or so people generally, they start with the wrong questions, I guess. What makes somebody successful in property? I think it's a long-term outlook, but there's also a certain level of tenacity, I think, that you need, because there is always summer and winter seasons, and people get flushed out in the winter seasons and spooked out of the market. Mm-hmm. And I think, I suppose the hardest thing for people is not following the crowd. It's exactly the same when you're buying an ETF, you know, you know, if you're buying a global ETF in a certain country, there'll be a period every so often when they get very, very cheap. And that's the time when everyone's getting out. And it's the same in housing. It's a psychological social proof, I guess. People feel, you see this in Sydney in 2016, 17. If there's 50 other people bidding on this terrace, well, they all want it. It must be a good investment. It's like, well, you're thinking about it the wrong way, because, you know, 2 years' time, there'll be one person bidding on that terrace, and it's not a better or worse investment because of that. It's just a cycle. But yeah, I guess that's just an awareness to the fact is that nothing performs well forever or badly forever.
Interesting. Good. You know, when I think about investors in the share market, I think they're the best investors that I know are pretty humble. They're open-minded. They're lifelong learners. You know, they commit to themselves as much as they commit to anything else. And I wonder if it's a similar set of personality traits that might lend themselves. And I imagine it would too.
100%. Yeah. And in fact, I have to almost catch myself sometimes, because with the advent of social media, so I know you've got like a Twitter account, great example. You get, I think of the 100 or so people I follow on Twitter, at least 5 of them have been Australia's best property analyst and best property information, best, you know, and, you get involved in these silly debates about, you know, this guy called that and you didn't, and this guy said that. And you just have to remember that all of that stuff is meaningless. You know, you need to take a step back and go, well, that's fine. People can't predict the future, as is shown in every cycle. And you just take a step away from it. And so think rationally. What are you doing for you? Don't get drawn into all those silly debates about, yeah, he said, she said.
Who was right?
Yeah, that's it. Because it's a rabbit hole, and it's a complete waste of your time.
Don't worry so much about who was right, just be right.
Try and just think logically, you know, and rationally, and try to detach yourself from all of that, because it doesn't serve any purpose. It's just a pissing contest about, you know, who's smarter than this guy. And what you find is that most people get some stuff right and some stuff wrong.
Here's a bit of a curveball for you. If I was asked what makes a really good investment on the share market, I might say things like no debt, or, you know, good valuation in terms of like low PE ratio, high returns on equity, etc. There's, you know, a million variables you could pull out and pick a handful that are your favorite. If you were thinking of your ideal property, what are some of the things that would have? Would it be apartment, house? Would you be buying it for positive yield, distance to amenities? What would be ideal?
I think if you're taking a long-term outlook, I mean, the oldest cliche in real estate is location, because there's a lot of things you can change about a real estate asset. You can change potentially the zoning. You can change the use. You can, you can do any number of things to layout, whatever, but you can't change the location. It's fixed in place. So if you've got a long-term outlook, then the location probably has to come first. And I think, I mean, in an ideal world, we'd all own big blocks of land close to the city where people want to live, you know. But one of the things that we've found over the years that, because we've been a Sydney and London focused, is you can't always afford, you know, the block that you want. That's the reality of it. So especially in the mature capital cities like London, you may well be looking at an apartment style property. So if that's the case, it's more about the land value content. So you typically say an investment grade, if you like, which is a bastardization of a term from the stock market. But I suppose an investment grade property, in inverted commas, would have a land value content of maybe 60% of the asset, even if it's an apartment. So you'd be looking at, if you're buying something that's on a strata or an apartment, then you'd be looking at a block of 4 or something like that. Because if you look at, let's take the most recent example. I've got no dog in this race, but if you look at something like the Sky Tower in Brisbane, it's 300 meters tall. I mean, each individual apartment, the land value, which is ultimately what does the heavy lifting for you on a real estate asset over the long term, the land value might be 3% or something of that nature. So there is no land value, you're just buying airspace. So the scarce commodity in Australian property is obviously well-located land. So I think first and foremost that, how you finance the investment, that's a whole other question. It's very much down to personal circumstances. And of course, change of government, that might actually, potentially trigger quite a lot of changes in terms of how people finance property. But, I think in terms of the best assets, it comes down to, well, it's the old cliche about supply and demand, but it's simple geometry, really, that the closer you get concentric circles to the heart of employment, there's just less land. And the further out you go, there is land as far as the eye can see. Mm. So, if you're looking over a 10, 20, 30-year time horizon, the scarce commodity is well-located land close to the city. Mm.
It sounds like from reading your books and the blog that you have a focus on high quality, just like a share market investor would have a focus on, like I said, companies with low debt and all the rest of it. You're willing to forgo it, the cheap stuff necessarily, and just focus on those assets that will stand the test of time.
Yeah, and I think this is where being an accountant gives you a bit of an edge, because it's a numbers game to some extent, because you can buy very cheap property in some parts of the country. Mm. You could buy a studio apartment in Cairns or the Northern Territory for very, very cheap levels. But what you quite quickly see when you look at other people's portfolios is that it only takes one repair bill. Somebody trashes the unit and there's a $5,000 or $10,000 repair. There goes your capital gains for years. So really, we've always figured that you'd be much better off owning a number of good quality, maybe higher value assets. And I'm not saying that that level of leverage is right for everyone. This is just our experience. But that's where we've seen all of the big results, have come from higher value, better quality properties. So, the stock market is a totally different beast. So I look at them as two, complementary but very, very different investments.
Okay. So there'll be a lot of share market investors, property investors listening to this. But for those who are probably yet to make their foray into property, who are some of the professionals that you swear by? I mean, you have a buyer's agency business, right?
Yes. So I would say if you're looking for, this must be true of any financial services business or sector, is that look at how people get paid. I would say if you're looking for a trusted professional, you want somebody who's charging a fee for service. They're not a vested interest in trying to push you into the classic thing in Aussie real estate has been not naming any names, but advisors pushing people into new apartments off the plan, quite often in Queensland for some reason, the White Shoe Brigade, because people are incentivized because they can take a commission from the developer. But think about that logically. If someone's recommending you do that, they're doing it for their benefit, not yours. And you'll find that when that property is 2 or 3 or 5 years old, it's lost its newness premium. It's depreciated. Your resale market will be thinner and you'll have lost money. So the accountant or financial advisor, whoever it was, salesman who put you into that property has taken a 6% commission or more sometimes, and you've done nothing good. So, and that's where I suppose when people see they report all this stuff about median prices have done this, there's a lot of moving parts that are behind that number, and a lot of people never make a cent from their investing in property.
Speaking of, you just mentioned buying off the plan. Is that something that you've ever recommended, or is that
not for? I wouldn't recommend it for other people. I have done it once in Sydney during the global financial crisis. So you could negotiate significant discounts because those properties weren't valuing up essentially. So people were exiting contracts, and we bought a place, a suburb called Erskineville in Sydney. I think it was 2009. And people just weren't completing on those contracts because they were falling over left, right and center. In that circumstance, for us, it made sense because you were buying a new property for the same price as the established ones locally, 2K from the city. Where people come unstuck in real estate, it's either because they get involved in a bidding war, the peak of a cycle, or quite often they buy off the plan from a brochure, property doesn't turn out to be what they thought it was, or very often they pay a price, which is essentially the developer's profit. But after 2 or 3 or 5 years or however long it is, you've no longer got a new asset. The resale value is going to be less. And 10 years down the track, people have achieved nothing but headaches. So, I don't personally recommend people do it. In fact, I'll put it stronger than that. You shouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you and me both. I've only heard bad stories come out of that.
Yeah. So you can, I suppose the only time I would say in Australia people have made decent money doing that is if, for example, if you buy off the plan in somewhere like Barangaroo, and you're kind of hoping that, well, in the 3 years or however long before that apartment settles, you might have made $1 million of equity, in which case you've essentially made money from thin air. But I mean, Sydney marches its to its own drum to some extent in premium real estate for that type of property, but I would say that's the exception, certainly not the rule.
Okay. I'm not a property investor, I'll be straight up. So I don't own property at the moment. In fact, I rent. But when I think about it, and you touched on it before, you said location is key for housing. And I think I messaged you about this not long ago, and the difference between house prices and attached dwellings. Do you own units?
Yeah, particularly in Sydney and London, because in those markets, while you'd always love to own a house in Bellevue Hill, realistically, that's not going to happen for most of us. Certainly as an investment, because the cash flow is just not going to stack up. So just as a general rule, if you're not familiar, you generally find that cheaper, less desirable housing has a high yield, and that yield represents a risk or a headache or a lack of growth or all of the above. The highest and most desirable property, the rental yields are typically extremely low. So unless you're buying for cash, it's hard to make those actually work.
So when you say extremely low, what might be an example? Well,
1%, 2%, who knows? Right. It depends on the, you know, if you're looking at the high, you know, the Barford estate in Bellevue Hill, yeah, sure, they get some good short stay lets. But, you know, if that house is worth $50 million, the rental yield's not going to be much. No. But it's, I guess the thing is with premium real estate, it's not really mum and dad investors in that type of property.
Mm. Speaking of yield, I've read a few books on property investing in Australia, and you know, I've done a fair bit of research, and some experts will tell you that when you're identifying a property to invest in, that it's preferable to find a property that's positively geared, or the holding costs do not outweigh the benefit that you receive from the property. Is that, in your opinion, does that have merit, that statement?
I suppose this is a difficult concept for people outside of Australia, even. The idea that you might buy an investment that doesn't make you money, I wouldn't say it's uniquely Australian, but it is partly related to the tax system. So, for example, I spoke at the UBS European conference, and on the panel with me was one of the most senior guys at the Bank for International Settlements, and he was talking to me with great interest about the concept of negative gearing, because he just couldn't get his head around it. Why would somebody invest in something if you're actually making a cash flow loss? So there's quite a lot of moving parts, though, to that statement. So a lot of people don't seem to understand you can be negatively geared but be making a positive cash flow. So that's one of the reasons that it's been so positive. And popular, I should say, in Australia, because the tax benefits can actually push what on the face of it looks like a loss-making property. But after the depreciation and the tax benefits, you can be in a positive cash flow situation. Right. But I would say it's difficult to generalize, because we found in our experience that buying the best, the higher quality properties, sometimes the rental yields aren't that much chop, because the value is all in the land. So for us, some short-term negative cash flow, well, we took a big picture approach, but I'm not saying that's right for everyone, because for some people cash flow is more critical. For us, we were two young professionals on higher incomes, and a bit of cash flow, you know, a few hundred bucks here or there wasn't going to make any difference to us. So it's different for different people.
I suppose it's a foreign concept for most people that look to the property market through a share market lens too, right?
For sure. Yeah. And that's why I say,
that's why I buy something.
Yeah.
Right?
And in fact, it's an interesting point, because quite often you find people who are diehard property people, they never really quite work out how to retire, because the cash flow on property, and we found this even for, the oldest property in our portfolio was bought mid-1990s. I mean, eventually it starts to throw off a good cash flow. But even then, you've got repairs, rates, maybe land taxes, property management costs. It's taxable. It's not tax efficient. So you would need one heck of a property portfolio to live solely off the rents in a very abundant fashion. So, and that's why I would encourage people to educate themselves about the stock market. Even if you're 100% property person, just get a familiarity. Even if you're investing a tiny amount, just start to understand how the cycles work. And, you know, you've done some amazing stuff on ETFs. Just learn about this stuff, because one day that's going to be your cash flow. And that's why I would suggest to people that even if they're starting with a small amount, get some familiarity with it. Yep. Because one of the things that, and we see this a lot in Britain, because interest rates are the zero lower bound, but people who've invested their whole lives in land and real estate, they don't trust the stock market, even with money in the bank earning 0.5%. You know, they still won't do it because they're just not familiar. They remember a stock market crash from 40 years ago. So that's why I say to people that even if you're starting small, just get some education on it, because in Australia in particular, we've got dividend yields that are what, double the MSCI global average, very generous franking credits. Mm-hmm. And it's almost tailor-made for retirement. So learn about it.
Yeah, that's your preach to the choir here. 10 properties in 10 years. You obviously, I'm guessing you're 28, say, when you had this shift and this plan, but you were independent by, financially independent by 33. Does that mean you were mortgage-free?
No. So I guess our thought process was this. We were, in round numbers, we were thinking, I guess, a net worth of about 3 million Aussie. Yep. If you can earn a comfortable 5% return on that cash, my thinking was 150K per annum. To me, that seemed like a decent kind of target. But at that stage, we still had our LVR on our properties was still higher than it was today, still had real estate costs. So it wasn't all free cash flow for us at that point. And in fact, we never did sell down any properties. We've kept investing, stock market, property market. But that was the thought process. Try and think of, well, what kind of passive income might you need? Maybe multiply that number by 20. And that could be a rough kind of a target. But yeah, we're still at this stage still accumulating. Yeah, like, it's different for different people, but it's nice to have that peace of mind to know that should you ever need to sell down some assets for any whatever reason, you've still got that level of equity that you can call on.
We say financially independent, but people might say, oh, look at Pete, he's still working, he still has businesses.
They do say that.
I couldn't imagine you not working or not doing something, right? So what is financial independence to you? What does that mean?
Well, when we finished up my last full-time role, we went traveling for about 15 months in the end. And I found it, I was very agitated for a number of weeks because I struggled with this whole concept of, so we drove the big lap of Australia, which was like 26,000 Ks, camper vanning. We did a world cruise with Cunard for, you know, Sydney to Southampton. It's a couple of months. And I guess we traveled something like 28 countries. But even during that time, I was still on, you know, financial news. I was going to the library, reading every finance book in the library. And that's when I actually wrote my first book, because maybe it's blokes, we're not very good at just relaxing and seeing the sights. So, to me, I even now, if I have a holiday, I would very rarely take a full day off. I still, you know, first thing in the morning, you know, I want to find out what's going on in the world. I try not to look at my emails first thing. It's a useful piece of advice I've learned, because that can set your day off on the back foot, responding to other people's requirements. But, I would very rarely have a full day not working. To me, it just doesn't feel right. These days I work in an area that I'm passionate about, so it doesn't feel like work. We took it was 15 months sort of break from business or work or anything like that, and I couldn't wait to get back into it. But it's different for different people. My wife was, she would happily be now still doing the same thing, I think.
So it's kind of the ability to do what you love, I suppose, is the, or what you want to do, really. Yeah, it's just that control, right?
Yeah, it's different for different people. So there's some amazing resource out there these days on financial independence, retire early. And I guess the model there is, for most people, like, minimize your expenses down to the bare minimum, you know, live on lentils, live on a caravan park, you know, whatever it is. There's some of those sites in the US. To me, that was never really much of a goal. I figure I like to think a bit bigger than that. But for us, I guess the the number. It would change over time because of inflation, but we're thinking a 3 million Aussie dollar net worth might be a good sort of a goal, because yeah, you can quite easily in Australia convert that to a 5% dividend income, and you're home and dry then, I guess. So, yeah, but it doesn't mean you necessarily stop there. You've got plenty of time on your side to keep going.
For sure. Let's shift now to some of the views that you have on the markets more recently. So we're recording this in 2019. One of the things, and this is not so much a view for this year or the next year, it's more of a structural thing. And if I peer over the fence and I look at property markets and how far we've come over, say, the last 10 or 20 years, in the past, there was, in my opinion, a lot of information and efficiency. You would have a property, a new property would come to market, and it might be in the local magazine or it could be in the local paper, and it would go to a select number of people. Now we have realestate.com, Domain, all these data providers. We have tremendous amounts of analysis and analytics going on. Does that make the market more efficient? Because we look at the share market, it's got, you know, we've got more data than we need.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. Same in real estate. Yeah.
And does that make pricing more efficient? Does it make being a bargain hunter harder?
Yeah, to some extent that's true. Yeah. So and especially when markets are buoyant, but generally most vendors have a pretty good idea of what they would like to get for a property, what they think it's worth. People generally don't just give stuff away for less than it's worth, unless sentiment is very weak, as it can be through the cycle. But I suppose there's a few different things there. So one is that the information isn't always great. For example, there's this kind of a rebuttable presumption that a suburb level analysis is a good way to measure prices. But why? You know, nobody's ever explained why that's the case. And if you think about it, that's a very arbitrary means of disaggregating figures. And sometimes it's the postcode level. But in Brisbane, a postcode could run from blue chip Riverside property in Chelmer all the way through, you know, Sherwood and Graceville and Corinda out to Oxley. It's an enormous area that's just captured by one number. And of course, within any suburb, you've got premium end, you've got the high side and low side in those suburbs, you've got some housing commission, you've got some premium riverside houses, apartments. So I think some of the statistics are tortured a little bit. But there's another thing in real estate too, is that what people want to do and what they can do in terms of financing, we've got this thing that I suppose it's called the credit cycle. I guess I see it more as a pendulum swinging towards too loose and too tight. So I think what people are able to do is sometimes beyond what they should do, and vice versa. So that is a big driver of trends. And also one thing that will never, I think, go away is this reflexive nature of markets. So the bull markets kind of feed on themselves, because people get to that point, and it's irrational for an investor, but for a home buyer, maybe not, that they start to worry that if they don't buy this month, well, they might be paying 50 grand in a month's time in Sydney, or you know, in 2 months' time, it might be 100 grand. And it just becomes this thing that feeds on itself. So those cycles at the peak and trough, I don't think will ever go away. You know, and the construction cycle will never go away. So even though markets might in some way be more efficient, the cycles haven't stopped, and the credit cycle certainly hasn't stopped. So
the behavior is still here.
Yeah, and the madness of crowds. I mean, I've seen it firsthand in recent years at both ends of the spectrum, and and in some of the mining towns, it was completely off the scale. So it just goes to show that human behavior hasn't improved much.
How about when you take a look at what we've seen, you know, the big structural macroeconomic variables that we consider, things like household debt, interest rates falling, and just the overall performance of the property market over, say, the last 10 or 20 years. Can that be sustained for the next 5, 10 or 20 years?
Yeah, well, if you look over 20 years, Australian property, ungeared, has actually outperformed the stock market, at least until a year ago. So to me, that doesn't make any logical sense, and I don't think that if you're looking 20 years forth, I don't think that's even possible, because as you mentioned, part of this is a structural thing. And to my own detriment, sometimes been cautioning people in Britain, because we started up as a buyer's agency in London, And I just say to people, just think about it. They've squeezed the living daylights out of interest rates here, where people have been borrowing at under 2%. Mm-hmm. We've had QE, interest rates at the zero lower bound for 10 years. There is nothing, there's no more juice to be squeezed out on that side of things. And, so, and that's why I see, you know, sometimes these resi funds raising money to go and buy, no names mentioned, but, you know, regional properties in Britain. And I'm not sure that's a great story, to be honest. I'm not saying there's not individual assets that might do okay, but the big structural change, as you mentioned, over, well, some decades now, has been interest rates and mortgage rates falling very substantially, and that's not going to be repeated. I mean, there's always things that could happen. I mean, maybe mortgage financing will become more global and there'll be more competition and more peer-to-peer lending, who knows? But yeah, we're not going to see interest rates fall from 10% to 5% again on a mortgage. So, so from that point of view, I think a structurally different decade ahead makes a lot more sense.
How are you positioning? Because you're a wealth coach and you work with clients. How are you positioning them? And what are the questions you're trying to get them to think about?
Oh, it's case by case. A lot of what I do is quite often with high net worths or people who've built up a substantial portfolio over a very long period of time. These days, people often have overseas assets in Singapore or Hong Kong or Britain. It's different for different people. So for a lot of people these days have to consider, well, how am I going to convert this equity into some kind of retirement, you know, strategy? And that's where some big picture thinking comes in. Where do you want to live? You know, in terms of location, but what type of property do you want to live in? Are there any implications of repatriation of funds? This is a thing that's faced us personally, because we've got assets in two countries. The tax years don't line up. You've got this stub period. You've got different tax rules in different jurisdictions. So I guess I've learned a phenomenal amount of stuff over the last 20 years as, accounting and tax compliance and real estate investing. So that's where I add most value with people. It's identifying what's your situation and where do you want to get to, and what are the considerations that you need to look at to get from where you are to where you want to get to.
We hear headlines, particularly in 2019, we've heard these really doom and gloom headlines for property investors. And there's probably some people listening to this that want me to ask this one question. Looking, you know, what we have in front of us now in 2019, is it as bad as what people think? And I suppose, what if you just have a best guess, what would you expect to see over the next 12 to 24 months from Australian property?
Yeah, I think it's a yes and no answer, because of course, you know, there is no one property market. It's a truism, but it is nevertheless the case that some markets have been very buoyant. You know, Tasmania and parts of Southeast Queensland. You know, I was living in New Farm for 4 years and listening to all this stuff about a property downturn, I'm like, well, you know, it doesn't look like it to me. But yeah, in Sydney in particular, so Sydney would have peaked last week of February 2017. You could pick it down to the weekend. It was an absolute, it was complete mayhem. APRA stepped in, introduced caps. We had interest only caps, and then there was a whole range of rules on LVRs and investor lending. So that killed the cycle, absolutely stone dead. I haven't really touched on it, but one of the third string to my bow, I guess, as a business person is as a market analyst, and I write reports for hedge funds and fund managers and so on. And this is something we warned about probably a little bit early in hindsight, but the risks in markets like Western Sydney, where median household income of say 55k, but people bidding up house prices for the yield or just because that's all they could afford. And when people are paying multiples of that they were, the risk in those markets, single income earners, I said at the time, you can't have fibro shacks compounding away at 12, 14, 16% when some of the best fund managers in the world are struggling to make those returns. That's not going to sustain. So I think in some of those markets, southwestern Sydney, Western Sydney, some pretty big fallout coming, I guess. One of the things we've learned from modeling over the years is that the supply responsive markets are often the hardest hit. So, because almost by definition, more people are buying at the peak and the downturn can get amplified. So if you're looking in Sydney, take a look at some of the areas around apartments in Liverpool or Epping, some parts of, I guess, Canterbury. So some of those areas where a very high uplift in the stock has happened in just a few years.
Is it always apartments or can it be new housing estates?
No, new housing estates as well. Yeah, so I'd guess in southwestern Sydney. I mean, we're not active in those markets, but just look at all housing market modelling. It was like where supply can respond because of the lag effect. You find a lot of those things that when they settle, they're not worth what people paid for them. There's a big clear out. So I would think it would be pretty easy to find. So there's a massive, massive surge in Chinese investment in Sydney. So if you went to a suburb like Epping, you could find an apartment that someone bought off the plan in 2014. You could probably pick that up today for 20% less. So when people talk about, you know, median prices, you've got to go beyond that and say, well, okay, because as I mentioned, places like some places like Darling Harbour, like some property markets with water views and stuff like that, they've hardly been touched. But yeah, you've got to go a level below just the median. But yeah, I still believe Sydney, there's still some fallout to come because there is an overhang of new apartments that were bought some years ago still coming onto the market. Sentiment's pretty low.
But you've said that you're still active in the market, right? Like your long-term plans.
Yeah, look, for, still buying. Yeah, so as a buyer's agent, we pretty much have done very little in Sydney. We actually, when the market went completely nuts, we were still searching, but we were looking at auctions and just saying that this doesn't make sense. You know, 50 people turning up to bid, you know, you're not going to buy something at a good price. So we weren't buying in that frenzied period. So most of what we've done in the last 4 or 5 years has been in Brisbane. But even within Brisbane, there's markets within markets because high-rise apartments, they've been overbuilt. And Brisbane also has flood zones and some sort of outer ring areas where you wouldn't necessarily want to invest. So you've got to pick your asset. But I guess the outperformers are good school zones and houses on good blocks in the inner west where you can just add value to them. That's the real upside in Brisbane.
Okay. Something for our listeners to go home and think about and maybe the area, jump on Google Maps and have a look around. This conversation, obviously there's a lot of, I'm asking you a lot of general questions because there's just so much to talk about and we've already gone a very long way over time. So I'm conscious of that. But as we come to the end of this, I think if you're an Australian investor, whether you're in property or not, on Twitter, on Instagram, you're one of the best followers there is because every day there's content. And you've got the blog. How can people find out more about you, the new book? Where can I subscribe to your blog? And what's your Twitter handle?
Just at Pete Wargent. But yeah, the easiest way, simply Google me. But my main website, PeteWargent.com. But I also have, as you mentioned, a daily blog, daily blog, Pete Wargent Blogspot.
I'll put it in the show notes as well.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, it's... yeah, some of my stuff's a bit nerdy and some of it's technical and some isn't. But I just enjoy writing. So as you said, there's always daily content. I do enjoy charts and so on. And it serves me well from a business point of view as well, because particularly for fund managers and hedge funds overseas, we've done a lot of stuff with them in recent years because Australia, you know, it's household debt and construction, all this stuff. It's interesting to hedge funds, mainly on the short side.
Yeah, for sure. Last question, my favorite. If you could go back and tell a younger you something about money, finance, investing, or even just life in general, what would it be?
Yeah, well, the most obvious thing is start today. But I think in my case would be actually to surround yourself with the right people, because you know, it's often said, oh, you know, you can't do what you did. You can't do it today. Well, maybe that might be literally true. You might not be able to do exactly the same thing. But by the same token, look at the opportunities that have opened up. I mean, you could be financially free in 1 year if you can set up an online business that generates income more than your expenses. So, yeah, just have an open mind and surround yourself with positive people who actually cheer your wins. And, don't surround yourself with cynics and naysayers because it won't help you.
Yeah. What's the saying? It's stay away from negative people because they'll find a problem to every solution.
Yeah, that's true. And it's true. You can't choose your family or your work colleagues and all the rest of it. But all I'm saying is maybe try and turn down some of the negativity and spend more time with people who actually are going to benefit you and you can learn from.
Wonderful advice, Pete. Thanks for joining me on the show. And also, thanks for your support throughout my journey as well. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. It's been, I don't know what my expectations were for the Rask podcast and all the rest of it, but you've wildly exceeded them. So it's been fantastic.
Now, mate, thanks for your support and shows like this help me. So thank you.
Pleasure. Cheers.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast. For further episodes, head to www.raskfinance.com. To provide feedback, nominate a guest or hear from me, you can find me on Twitter with the handle @OwenRask. Cheers to our financial futures.